Chapter 2. Gothic Rebellion. As a young girl, many of Mary Shelley's favorite books were Gothic tales of horror and romance. She immersed herself in the works of novelists such as Anne Radcliffe and Matthew Lewis, but also those of her parents, as they, too, had written dark and thrilling works. Gothic works were notorious for violent and shocking plots, with supernatural twists and turns, including ghosts, murders, villains, ruins, horrors, gloomy settings, secrets, innocent maidens, and evil tyrants. Frequently, the young heroines were persecuted or suffered torture of some kind. Sometimes they persevered based on the strength of their spirit, other times because they were rescued by a young hero. For a lonely young girl, the line between fiction and reality often blurred, and the circumstances of Mary Shelley's life helped her see herself as a Gothic heroine, persecuted and wronged by a villain, though, in her case, the tyrant she faced was not an evil man, but a woman, her stepmother, Mary Jane Claremont. As she wrote to Percy, "I detest Mrs. G." Mary Jane Claremont. Stepmother and stepdaughter locked horns right from the beginning, although Mary Shelley was only 4 years old when they met. Their conflicts distressed everyone in the household, but fighting with her stepmother actually helped shape Mary Shelley into an independent young woman. As she grew older, with no one to advocate for her inside her own family, she learned to argue for what she wanted in the face of Mary Jane's resistance. Mary Shelley's dislike of Mary Jane was exacerbated by the fact that before Mary Jane's arrival, she had been the star of the household. Visitors flocked to the house to meet the daughter of Wollstonecraft and Godwin. Delicate, with pale skin, coppery curls, enormous eyes, and a tiny mouth, the young celebrity did not disappoint her admirers. Visitors reported that she was the most intelligent child they had ever seen. One of her particular admirers was the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who first met her in the winter of 1799 when he was 27 and Mary Shelley was 2. A devoted follower of Godwin, but even more so of Wollstonecraft, the young poet was alarmed by how well-behaved the Godwin girls were. Godwin's coldness was harming the two young girls, Coleridge thought, telling his friend that they should be more like his own 3-year-old son, who rode the wind like a bird, using the air of the breezes as skipping ropes. In later years, when he came to visit, he always made a point of visiting the girls and drawing them out. Fanny was shy and tended to hold back, but Mary Shelley loved hearing him tell stories and sat at his feet, entranced. When her father married Mary Jane, Mary was immediately demoted from her position of ascendancy, as Godwin was smitten with his new wife. Even worse, Mary Jane brought 2 children into the marriage, Charles and Jane. Charles was about the same age as Fanny, but he was away at school much of the time, and so did not figure much in the family dramas. And dramas there were. Seeing herself as a warrior for the cause of her dead mother, Mary Shelley resented everything about Mary Jane, from the special treatment she doled out to her own children to her usurpation of her mother's place. Jane, who was 6 months younger than Mary Shelley and admired her stepsister, took Mary Shelley's side. Fanny, insecure and shy, tried to avoid the conflicts between her half-sister and stepmother. But Jane rejoiced in the excitement, doing her best to stir up conflicts. Matters were made worse by Godwin's obvious favoritism. He ignored the other children, focusing largely on his own daughter. Jane was jealous, but as Mary Shelley would later make clear, it was not easy to bear Godwin's scrutiny. She often felt she disappointed him and yearned to have a mother who loved her, a dream that fueled her hatred of Mary Jane. And yet, despite Mary Shelley's enmity, Mary Jane was not a villain. She could be irritating, and she did favor her own children. But she was also an excellent businesswoman, keeping the family afloat financially, as Godwin was notoriously bad with money. She was also an intellectual, She had translated The Swiss Family Robinson from the French, and with Godwin, started the Juvenile Library, a publishing imprint and bookstore dedicated to children's literature and educational books. Before long, she became the most prominent female publisher in London. With some help from Godwin, it is possible she and her stepdaughter could have forged a bond. But Godwin locked himself in his study and ignored their fights, allowing Mary Jane to rule the household. As for Mary Shelley, the more she fought with her stepmother, the more she longed for Wollstonecraft, imagining her as the perfect, all-loving mother. One famous conflict occurred when Mary Shelley was 8 years old. Coleridge paid the family a visit and announced that he would recite from his new poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, after dinner. In the past, Godwin had always let his girl stay up late to listen to Coleridge tell stories and recite his poems, but on this particular evening, Mary Jane put her foot down and sent the children up to bed. Determined to hear her old friend's poem, Mary Shelley stole downstairs, with Jane close behind. The two girls hid behind the couch to listen to the poet, and for the rest of Mary Shelley's life, she would be able to recall each word, reciting lines of the poems to the poets she would later come to know, ensuring Coleridge's influence on the next generation of romantic writers, but also using many of his themes and imagery in her own work, from Frankenstein to Faulkner. When Mary Jane discovered the girls, she wanted to punish them, but Godwin and Coleridge stopped her. If there had been any hope of reconciliation between stepdaughter and stepmother, it was over. With this act of defiance, Mary Shelley aligned herself with her father and his friend, casting off any pretense of obedience to Mary Jane. To Mary Shelley, her stepmother stood for mediocrity and the limitations of the conventional woman's world, everything she wanted to escape, everything that her mother had fought against. Inspired by her reading of Gothic romances, it was an easy next step to make Mary Jane into a symbol, a figure of oppression, someone to set herself against, a Gothic villain. It is to Mary Jane's credit that she always strove to take care of her angry stepdaughter, at least from a practical standpoint. She nursed her when she was sick, even accompanying her to Ramsgate as part of a cure for stubborn eczema on her arm. She took all the children on outings to the parks and theater and made sure their meals were healthy and their clothing suitable and clean. But for all of Mary Jane's efforts, Mary Shelley's rebelliousness only grew more pronounced. The tension escalated until when Mary Shelley was 14, Godwin felt compelled to send her away to a family living in Dundee, Scotland. He had never actually met the Baxters, but had corresponded with them about radical politics, and apparently this was enough for him. When Mary Shelley arrived in June 1812, Scotland was already famous as a land of romance for the 19th-century literary tourists. Coleridge and the Wordsworths had made a pilgrimage there. Dorothy, the sister of the poet, declared, "Scotland is the country above all others that I have seen in which a man of imagination may carve out his own pleasures." Scotland was also the home of the Highlanders, who staged countless revolts against the crown. Sir Walter Scott had published his dramatic poem, The Lady of the Lake, in 1810, and throngs of English travelers visited the Highlands, reciting Scott's words as they hiked down gorges and gazed at plunging waterfalls. To Mary Shelley, Scott's noble heroine, Ellen Douglas, embodied all she hoped to become, beloved, brave, and tragic. Although the Highlanders had surrendered by the time Mary Shelley arrived, there was still unrest in the countryside. It was illegal to play the bagpipes, and the ban against wearing a tartan had only recently been lifted, as both were symbols of rebellion. Stories of brave heroes and heroines haunted the young woman's imagination. For a teenage girl, these dangers seemed thrillingly romantic. She aligned herself with the rebels, casting herself in the role of defiant freedom fighter, although her opponent was Mary Jane, not the English government. Mary Shelley would spend almost 2 years in Scotland, with only one trip home. In later years, she would look back on this time as an important interlude in her development as a writer. describing Dundee as an Aerie of freedom. She recounted her time alone in the fields, dreaming of stories she wanted to tell. To a girl like Mary Shelley, Scotland was a magical land, wreathed in legend, the perfect place to let her imagination roam free and cultivate her sense of being a Gothic heroine. Indeed, in her second novel, Matilda, the heroine spends a lonely childhood in Scotland, dreaming of the father who has abandoned her. Isabella Baxter, the youngest daughter of the household, soon became Mary Shelley's close friend and helped fuel her revolutionary spirit. Isabella revered Mary Wollstonecraft and was delighted to know her daughter. An enthusiastic student of the French Revolution, she inspired Mary Shelley by discussing the courageous feats of Charlotte Corday and Madame Roland, heroines of the Revolution, declaring that she intended to follow their example and fight tyranny in all its forms. This passionate relationship with history was a revelation for Mary Shelley. Isabella scoured the past for clues about the present, for ideas about how to live a truly revolutionary life. Summoned home at the age of 16, Mary Shelley stepped off the ship in London, even more dedicated to the cause of rebellion than before she left. Like the Scottish Highlanders, she would be a revolutionary. Like her friend Isabella, she would emulate the radical women of the French Revolution. But back in London, her opportunities for revolution were limited. As Wollstonecraft had observed in her first book, Thoughts on the Education of Daughters, there were few freedoms for a young woman in Mary Shelley's position. Unless she married, she would have to remain at home with her father and stepmother. As one of the daughters of the house, it seemed unlikely that she could overthrow the rule of Mary Jane. She had no money of her own and no prospect of earning any. It also seemed unlikely that she could marry, as Godwin, who had always struggled financially, was deeply in debt, and few suitors would want a bride without a dowry. The only other choices for a young woman of her background were to be a teacher, a governess, or lady's companion, positions that would hardly advance the cause of freedom. For Mary Shelley, well-versed in her mother's quest for independence, her life now seemed a disappointment, without liberty, without love, and with no chance to live up to the legacy of her mother. She wanted to fight her own battles of liberation. At the very least, she wanted to vanquish her opponent, Mary Jane Claremont. Percy Shelley. But Mary Shelley's life was about to take a dramatic turn. Before long, she would outdo even Wollstonecraft in her own bid for independence. Her father had recently met a young admirer, Percy Shelley, a radical, who was also the son of a baronet. Percy revered Godwin for his stance on political liberty and had promised to help Godwin financially in return for his advice on how to reform the world. An activist and an idealist, he had just returned from organizing protesters against English rule in Ireland. Percy had a powerful effect on those who met him. His friend, Thomas Jefferson Hogg, described him as wild, intellectual, unearthly, like a spirit that has just descended from the sky, like a demon risen at that moment out of the ground. Later, Mary Shelley would describe him as sensitive, impetuous, and generous. He had a wicked sense of humor and a propensity for shocking people. Expelled from Oxford for writing a fiery tract announcing his atheism, his renegade behavior recommended him to Mary Shelley. Ordinary people could not understand him, she wrote, as he loved to idealize reality and dwelt in the wildest regions of fancy. Godwin had told his daughter and the rest of his family that they had to win Percy's approval, as he desperately needed the young man to pay his debts. But this would turn out to be a problem, since Percy was dependent on his father for money, and Sir Timothy, appalled by his son's behavior, was currently withholding funds to ensure his son's obedience. As a result, each penny that Percy wrested from his family's estate was the result of long, bitter legal proceedings. If Mary Shelley was eager to meet Percy, Percy was even more excited to meet the child of Godwin and Wollstonecraft, the two icons of political liberty whom he most admired. With such parents, he was sure that this young woman would be extraordinary. Months before they met, he had gazed at the large portrait of Wollstonecraft in Godwin's study, intrigued to hear that young Mary was very much like her mother. 2 years later, he would immortalize her heritage, writing, "They say that thou wert lovely from thy birth, of glorious parents, thou aspiring child." When the big day came and Percy arrived at their house for dinner, it was clear to Mary Shelley that he was unlike any young man she had ever met. Right from the start, he announced his radical beliefs, as though he were trying to outdo her own father. He embraced revolution, condemned the English oppression of the Irish, thought the monarchy should be overthrown, and hated organized religion. He did not care if he shocked people. In fact, he seemed to embrace it. Even his appearance was unconventional. He wore his shirt open. His hair was long and messy. His eyes flashed when he spoke. The two young people were drawn to each other immediately. According to Thomas Hogg, not only was Mary Shelley fair-haired, pale indeed, and with a piercing look, she was also wearing a tartan she had bought in Scotland to mark her support of the rebellious Highlanders and her identity as a revolutionary. Here was a woman who could match Percy's idealistic fervor. However, there was a stumbling block. Percy was already married to an 18-year-old named Harriet Westbrook. To an ordinary young woman, this would have made Percy off-limits, but Mary Shelley had read and reread the books of her parents. Wollstonecraft had condemned marriage in A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, and in his first edition of Political Justice, Godwin had declared, "Marriage, as now understood, is a monopoly, and the worst of monopolies. So long as two human beings are forbidden, by positive institution, to follow the dictates of their own mind, prejudice will be alive and vigorous." Accordingly, when Percy told Mary Shelley that Harriet did not share his political philosophy, and he no longer considered himself married, Mary Shelley immediately declared her love. As Percy later recalled, she was inspired by a spirit that sees into the truth of things. To her, Percy's refusal to stay with a woman he no longer loved made him seem admirable. Here was someone who listened to the dictates of his heart, not societal rules, who shared her philosophy of freedom and wanted to live with integrity, like Wollstonecraft. However, she did not appear to think of Harriet's precarious situation. Abandoned by her husband, Harriet was left vulnerable, particularly as she and Percy already had one child, Ianthe, and were expecting a second. Breaking the rules that were supposed to govern young ladies, she took Percy to her mother's grave, where they lay on the grass in front of her mother's gravestone, and, as Mary Shelley said, embraced with the full ardor of love. What exactly she meant by these words is not clear, as it seems unlikely that they fully consummated their relationship in the churchyard, given all the difficulties involved, the public setting, the dangers of exposure, Mary Shelley's inexperience, and the complicated undergarments worn by 19th-century English women. Nevertheless, they marked this day as the start of their sexual relationship. Percy immortalized this moment in the dedication of his poem, The Revolt of Islam. How beautiful and calm and free thou wert in thy young wisdom, when the mortal chain of custom thou didst burst and rend in twain. Mary Shelley had indeed burst the chain of custom. Elated as she was, she had no idea how much she would suffer for this bold step. In Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, which was being readied for publication even as Mary Shelley was kissing Percy in the graveyard, Pretty Maria, who runs away with a scoundrel, is cast out from society. The same would be true for Mary Shelley. She would spend much of her youth in social exile, struggling against those who blamed her for being a renegade. As the years passed, she would also have to face how much she had contributed to Harriet's heartbreak. But at the time, this dramatic break was part of the attraction to Percy. If she wanted to be like her mother, If she wanted to be a true heroine, she needed to resist convention and embrace freedom. After all, this is what Wollstonecraft had done with Imlay and her own father, and this is what she had defended in all of her books. Liberty, the right to live one's life the way one wanted, and the freedom to express one's thoughts. As a result, it did not occur to her that her father might be angry. She was sure that he, the great philosopher of freedom, the man who had recommended Percy so enthusiastically, would heartily approve. But when Godwin and Mary Jane learned of the affair, Mary Shelley was shocked at their furious response. Mary Jane's disapproval she wrote off as yet more evidence of her mediocrity. However, her father's rage felt like a betrayal, not just of herself, but of the principles he supposedly shared with Wollstonecraft. Not only had Godwin let her down, he refused to stand up for his own ideals, and even more importantly, those of Wollstonecraft. At no point did she seem aware of the fact that Godwin had decided to compromise his principles for her sake and for the sake of her mother when they had married 16 years earlier. To her, his disapproval seemed hypocritical and served to harden her resolve to stay true to Percy. Over the years, her disappointment in Godwin never truly abated. In many of the portraits of fathers that she painted in her fiction, the fathers betray or disappoint their daughters. Escape. On 28 July, early in the morning, the young couple fled to Paris, taking Jane with them. Why Jane came along is a mystery. Perhaps they needed her help to escape the Godwins. Maybe Percy wanted to liberate her from social convention, as this is what he felt he had done with Harriet, and now Mary Shelley. Perhaps this was the price she had extracted for serving as their secret messenger. Or maybe he and Jane were on the cusp of an affair themselves, as all three young people had professed their commitment to free love, viewing fidelity for the sake of fidelity as hypocritical. At any rate, Mary Shelley's motivation for including her stepsister in this adventure is particularly unclear, as she and Jane still had a fraught relationship, alternating between love and jealousy. The trio spent 3 difficult months wandering around Europe without enough money, and when they returned to London, 17-year-old Mary Shelley was pregnant. They had hoped to be welcomed home as revolutionaries and iconoclasts, but they were shunned by everyone they had once known and were penniless, as Percy's father, scandalized by his son's behavior, had cut off all of his funding. The three young people took inspiration from the example of Wollstonecraft, taking lodgings in Somerstown to be near Wollstonecraft's grave. Tired and sick, Mary Shelley suffered as Percy turned his attentions increasingly to Jane. Jane had already infuriated her stepsister by declaring that she, too, was an acolyte of Wollstonecraft and had decided to change her name to Claire as a symbol of her new identity. The Godwins refused to speak to Mary Shelley, though Mary Jane allowed Claire to visit the family home, and Fanny made secret visits when she could. Isolated and worried, Mary Shelley turned to books, beginning what would become a lifelong program of self-education, a habit that she would bestow on the strongest, most resourceful heroines in her novels. Each day, she spent hours learning Greek, Latin, and Italian, and read widely, meticulously recording her reading in her diary. Mary Shelley's commitment to her own learning was inspired in large part by her mother's emphasis on the importance of women's education. Wollstonecraft criticized those who claimed that women should only be taught those skills that would please men. Women were not the playthings of men, Wollstonecraft had declared. They were entitled to the same natural rights, and if they were allowed to have a real education, not only would their own situations improve, but society would be a better place. Men would be liberated from caring for women as though they were children, and would also be spared from becoming tyrants. Children, too, would benefit, as a well-educated mother would be better able to fulfill her responsibilities. Dependent on Percy, with no money of her own, and cut off from her family, Mary Shelley was determined to become the independent woman her mother had envisioned by improving her mind and strengthening her skills as a writer. But first, she had to correct the bad habits of her youth. Although she had been allowed to read any book in Godwin's library, she had never pursued a systematic course of study. Now, she applied herself to her work, asking Shelley, the recipient of an excellent classical education, for guidance. He helped her with Greek and Latin, and together, they read many of the classics of English literature, including The Faerie Queen and Paradise Lost. Although she devoted herself to these high-minded pursuits, she still steeped herself in the Gothic novels she loved, particularly Radcliffe's The Mysteries of Udolpho and Lewis's The Monk. She also read her father's novel, Saint Leon, in which a French aristocrat searches for the elixir to eternal life, but ends the story as a lonely wanderer. Like Victor Frankenstein and his creature, he is separated from the rest of humanity. She also reread her mother's final unfinished novel, Maria, or The Wrongs of Woman, which begins in true Gothic fashion with a mysterious heroine locked in an asylum for reasons she does not yet know. In the preface, Wollstonecraft had written that her goal was to portray passions, not manners, a declaration that inspired Mary Shelley. She, too, wanted to capture the truth of the heart, just as Percy said she had done when she declared her love for him in the graveyard. In the mid-18th century, the Gothic novels that Mary Shelley loved would have been dismissed as superstitious and sensationalist, but supernatural themes had recently risen to prominence in literary circles, elevated in part by the ideas of the political philosopher Edmund Burke. In A Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Our Ideas of the Sublime and Beautiful, Burke argued that terror, pain, and fear generated an experience of what he termed the sublime, the strongest possible feeling in the onlooker. He wrote that terror could lead one to a transcendent experience, beyond the trivialities of the mundane world. Romantic poets, in particular, embraced these principles, seeking out themes that would initiate the experience of the sublime in their readers and would assert their own poetic visions. Mary Shelley had long been exposed to the romantic sublime through the works of her parents and their friends. Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner had thrilled her with its terrifying supernatural elements, the ghost ship and the solitary figure of the mariner, haunted by his crime of shooting the albatross. The mariner is cursed by the spirit, life in death, to endure a kind of everlasting spiritual torture. He cannot die, but neither can he be fully alive. At last, he is restored to life by appreciating the beauty of the sea creatures he sees alongside the ship, and emerges, transformed by his experience. In February, Mary Shelley gave birth, prematurely, to a little girl, who died 2 weeks later. Night after night, she dreamed the baby lived, writing in her journal, "Dream that my little baby came to life again, that it had only been cold, and that we rubbed it by the fire, and it lived." Like the life-and-death punishment that Coleridge's mariner endured, these dreams revealed Mary Shelley's curse. Her mother had died because of her, and now her baby had died as well, but lived on in some sublime and terrifying way. Haunted as she was by this experience, it should come as no surprise that the idea of the dead coming back to life would be one of the central themes of Frankenstein, the novel that she would start writing only a year later. That spring, she discovered that she was pregnant again, giving birth to a second child, William, in January 1816. Claire, meanwhile, had begun a love affair with the poet Lord Byron, the most famous literary figure of the period, and the most notorious. At the time, rumors were circulating that he was having an affair with his half-sister, and he was facing legal action from his estranged wife. Even his oldest friends had turned their backs on him, and he was eager to flee England. When Claire heard that he had planned a trip to Geneva that summer, she proposed joining him there with her stepsister, Percy, and baby William. Although he was lukewarm about continuing his relationship with Claire, Byron was eager to meet the daughter of Wollstonecraft and Godwin, as well as the young poet Percy, whose exploits had intrigued him from afar. As for Mary Shelley, she had long admired Byron's poetry, and she was eager to take William out of the city for the summer. The air was thick with smoke, and she worried about his health. That May, they set forth for Switzerland, little realizing that they were heading toward an adventure that would shape literary history forever.